Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome, welcome, welcome on this lovely Sunday morning with myself, Muhammad Lambat, on Radio Islam, Medium Wave 1548, on the Globe Trotting program, Alhamdulillah, where we go globe trotting around the world, and that's what we enjoy doing. Fantastic, Alhamdulillah. And as we always say, and I mention it time and time again, the world is becoming one small global village, and we've seen it. And also, previously, if anybody, I say this time and time again as well, where previously people had to go overseas, it was a big issue. It was a thing where you had to give dawah to everybody. I'm going here, I'm going there, I'm doing things like this. Today, technology and advancements has become such that you get into the plane, within a couple of hours you're on the other end already, do what you have to do, get into the plane, within a few hours you're back again. Sometimes people don't even know you've been abroad. And that happens all the time. And it's become, the life has become a chase, and that's what happens. And we find many a times people go abroad, and, you know, it's just, it's we don't realize how much more travel is being done now. We always say that people used to travel more before. But if you look at the way it's done now, we don't know that people are going abroad and come back again. So it's the information that we have, our personal statistics that we have in our minds, is reduced, obviously, because we are unaware of that. But Alhamdulillah, there are many people that are traveling abroad. Fortunately, as we heard last week, we were afforded the opportunity. We were invited by the Malaysian Tourism Board and for conferences on tourism and promotion of tourism. And it's just amazing that some countries dedicate their countries to tourism. And that is what brings them the income to their countries. Unlike some others who impose rules and regulations that deter people from coming to their countries. Which is sad, because if you look at tourism in itself, in any country of the world, is a business which improves the conditions of the country's tourist places and attractions, and also the economy. If you look at Malaysia now that we just got back with all the statistics that we've got there as well, they are just amazing, and a lot of statistics that I picked up, which I will have a dedicated show with a representative from Tourism Malaysia as well, or from the embassy, where we're going to be talking about Malaysia. But just briefly, it was great to note the Malaysian population is between 28 and 30 million currently. Last year, the tourism statistics, inbound tourists into Malaysia, from road, sea, and air, was 27.2 million visitors. Now, you're looking at the number of tourists almost equivalent to the number of residents of that country. Now, that, we wonder how, what's the big deal about that? For every tourist that go into the country, you look at the person flying in, first of all, has to buy the ticket, which benefits the airlines, whichever airlines they are. Once they get in, beyond the borders, they need a SIM card, for example, at the airport. So they buy the SIM card. And by them buying the SIM card, all they're doing is they are now contributing towards that aspect or that fact, that part of the economy. That's the communication part of the economy. And from there, they go on out of the airport, they get into a taxi. That taxi driver, who was probably unemployed, but because of all the tourists coming into the country at the airport, has now got a job because he's got to take them to a destination from the airport. So now, one job has been created. He's now self-sufficient, irrespective of him having his own taxi or working for a company. That's point number two. From there on, that particular visitor goes to the nearest hotel, for example. Get into the hotel, they need the concierge office, concierge counter, they need the porters, all those the ground staff there. They need to assist the particular visitor into the hotel. So they come, they carry the bags out, they put the bags onto the trolleys, they come to the reception, they wait with you there, they take your room number, they put it on your bag, and they're now waiting to take your bags to the room. And that man is employed simply because you, as a tourist, have gone to that country. So now that man is employed. So there's another employment factor that's come up there. From there, you have all those staff behind the desk, the reception desk. Those people are simply employed because there are people coming into the country and using those hotels. By them using the hotels, obviously, you need to increase your staff at the hotels, depending on how big the hotel is. Those people have got employment. Now, the number of visitors in the rooms that you have, the rooms needs to be cleaned. People have to be employed to clean the rooms. There's another employment factor there. And from there now you look at coming after the rooms, getting all that done, all those soaps and those amenities that you get in the rooms, toothbrushes, soaps, shavers, all that, all those small little items which we oversee, those items have to be bought from a certain company to be placed into the hotels, because you as a foreigner has come to visit that hotel and that country. So those things are bought from a company in and around the country, sourced from in and around the country, brought into the hotels. That company has also got employment, because now the hotels are buying from them. More employment there. Coming downstairs again, now you're looking for tours. You get to the reception office, or you get to the reception counter, you ask them for tours, you get your tours sorted out. All these factors, now I'm only outlining a few factors which I have just briefly thought of. There are much, much, much more factors which brings to mind that tourism, one simple tourist that leaves his country to visit another country, that piece of tourism creates so much of employment, and that uplifts the country. And you see that, you see the upliftment in that particular country. Now, if you're looking at the statistics which were given to us, 27.2 million visitors last year going to Malaysia with a 28 to 30 million population, what does that tell you? The rate of unemployment will be reduced drastically. You need not depend on manufacturing sector, on some technical office, whatever it means, and force your way into employment. Automatically, employment gets created, and we've seen it. And these people have proven it to us. And that is why what Malaysia has done, which I have now highlighted this to a few embassies during the week as well, the concept that they've used is to get groups coming in where they market the country, show those groups, the country as a whole, go from tourist attraction place to another, visit all the interesting sites, show everybody those sites, come back again and now market the country. And automatically, they say that this has proven to them where it just boosts inbound tourism. And it makes a difference. And there you see the tour guides are all official tour guides. They go for courses. They get certificates. They must now become tour guides. There are so many tour guides. Wherever you go, there are so many tour guides. And they're all employed. So we got to look at this very, very carefully. Well, we're looking at it from our small side. But on the bigger picture, we got to look at it from government level. And that will make a huge difference. A huge difference. So inshallah, it was very interesting. We will talk about that. And Malaysia is a lovely country, I must say that. But anyway, today I'm going to be getting off at about 10. I have some emergencies that came up, so I'll be finishing off just before the news. But briefly, I want to talk about how the British divided the Arab world. The development of the modern nation states throughout the Arab world is a fascinating and heartbreaking process. About 100 years ago, most Arabs were part of the Ottoman Empire, the Khalifate, a large multi-ethnic state based in Istanbul. Today, a political map of the Arab world looks like a complex jigsaw puzzle, I would say. A complex and intricate course of events in the 1910s brought about the end of the Ottomans and the rise of the new nations, with borders running across the Middle East, dividing Muslims from each other. While there are many different factors leading to this, the role that the British played in this was far greater than any other player in the region. Three separate agreements made conflicting promises that the British had to stand by. The result was a political mess at the time that divided up a large part of the Muslim world that we see today. And if you look at the map of the Middle East, you see it's divided into all those small, small countries. And at one stage, it was one big family. Well, the outbreak of World War I in about 1914, when World War I broke out in Europe, a complex system of alliances, a militaristic arms race, colonial ambitions, and a general mismanagement at the highest government levels led to this devastating war that claimed the lives of about 12 million people from 1914 to 1918. On the Allied side stood the empires of Britain, France, in Russia. The central powers consisted of Germany and Austria-Hungary. At first, the Ottoman Empire decided to remain neutral. they were not nearly as strong as any of the other nations fighting in the war, and were wrecked by internal and external threats. The Ottoman Sultan was nothing more than a figurehead at the time, I would say. And with the last powerful Sultan, which was Abdul Hamid II, having been overthrown in about 1908 and replaced with a military government led by the three Pashas, which I had spoken about as well previously, the Pashas of the Ottomans. And they were from the secular westernized group. And the young Turks, financially, the Ottomans were in a serious bind, owing huge debts to the European powers. And they were not able to pay their debts at the time. After trying to join the Allied side and being rejected, the Ottomans sided with the Central Powers in October 1914. Now, we're looking at that time being the time of World War I, yes. And at that time, you have all these different powers. Now, it's all power struggle and power hungry. The British immediately began to conceive of plans to dissolve the Ottoman Empire and expand their Middle Eastern Empire. They had already had control of Egypt since about 1888. And India, they had control of since 1857. And the Ottoman Middle East lay right in the middle of these two important colonies. And the British were determined to exterminate it as part of the World War. And then you had the Arab Revolt. One of the British strategies was to turn the Ottoman Empire's Arab subjects against the government. And you know, that's the sad part of it. And they found a ready and willing helper in the Hejaz, the western region of the Arabian Peninsula. Sharif Hussein bin Ali, the Emir of Mecca at the time, entered into an agreement with the British government to revolt against the Ottomans. And his reasons for allying with the foreign British against other Muslims remain uncertain at the time. Well, you know, if you look at it, bottom line today, I would say there's probably money that exchanged hands, and that's what happened. Possible reasons for his revolts were also disapproval with the Turkish nationalist objectives of the three Pashas. And then he also had a personal feud with the Ottoman government, or simply a desire for his own kingdom at the time. So he wanted the Arabian kingdom for himself. And whatever his reasons were, Sharif Hussein decided to revolt against the Ottoman government in alliance with the British. And in return, the British promised to provide money and weapons to the rebels to help them fight the much more organized Ottoman army. And also the British promised him that after the war, he would be given his own Arab kingdom that would cover the entire Arabian Peninsula, including Syria and Iraq. The letters in which the two sides negotiated and discussed the revolt were known as the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, as Sharif Hussein was communicating with the British High Commissioner in Egypt at the time, and his name was Henry McMahon. And in June 1916, Sharif Hussein led his group of armed Bedouin warriors from the Hejaz in an armed campaign against the Ottomans. And then within a few months, the Arab rebels managed to capture numerous cities in the Hejaz, including Jeddah and Mecca. And with the help of the British Army and Navy, the British provided support in the form of soldiers, weapons, money, advisors, including the legendary Lawrence of Arabia, and a flag, which they needed. And the British in Egypt drew up a flag for the Arabs to use in the battle, which was known as the flag of the Arab Revolt at the time. And this flag later became the model for other Arab flags of the countries such as Jordan, Palestine, Sudan, Syria, Kuwait. They all used a similar type of flag at the time and currently. As World War I progressed through 1917 and 1918, the Arab rebels managed to capture many, many major cities from the Ottomans. As the British advanced into Palestine and Iraq, capturing cities such as Jerusalem and Baghdad, the Arabs aided them by capturing Amman and Damascus. And it is important to note that the Arab revolt did not have the backing of a large majority of the Arab population. And it was a minority movement led by a few leaders who sought to increase their own powers, which we see today as well with all these fights that are going on. It's not, these small little groups are not representing Muslims as a whole. It's pockets that are representing their own, for their own agenda they're going forward. In the name of Islam, with all the problems that we had this past week, this past few months, we're having all these bombings and all these suicide bombings. It's not the majority of Muslims that are advocating this. But Muslims are tarnished with this simply because it's in the name of Islam. And that's what happened then too. The vast majority of Arab people stayed away from the conflict and did not support the rebels or the Ottoman government. Sharif Hussein's plan to create his own Arab kingdom was succeeding so far. If it were not for other promises the British would make then, but before the Arab revolt could even begin, and before Sharif Hussein could even create his own kingdom, the British and French had other plans. So there are so many things which they wanted to do, and they wanted to destroy the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. And they managed to do that. And that is why today we find that they have separated the whole of the Arabian Peninsula into pieces. And the way they made those pieces in the Arabian Peninsula, and they have then created such animosity between the different states, and they have now, the way we look at it, you have rebels within the country, and that's what creates all these problems, unfortunately. And that's the sad part of it. And then you have the Balfour Declaration as well. And then you have the three conflicting agreements. You know, the whole, it's quite a lengthy issue, this. I am out of time already, but it's quite a lengthy issue. I will visit this whole program again on the Middle Eastern conflict and the way the whole Middle East has been just broken up and brought into pieces and the problems of the Middle East today. But we just got to sit and make dua to the Almighty Allah that He must protect the Muslims throughout the world. So inshallah, make it easy for us all, inshallah. I am going to go off. I got some emergency that just came up. And inshallah, what we'll do is next week we will carry on with another program. I do have something planned for next week. But inshallah, from myself, Muhammad Lambat, until next week, same place, same time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.